Stephen Stone, clinical social worker, is a psychotherapist, computer consultant, and purveyor of Palm Top computers. He was one of the original members of the Santa Barbara K-Pro Users Group, formed in 1983, and is a current member of the Santa Barbara Classic Computer Society. Besides the K-Pro 20 and Epson PX8 computers still used for word processing and small business accounting in his office, at any one time, his garage has a score or more of old 8-bit machines stored in nooks and crannies. Stephen has introduced older computers to the social service agencies in which he has worked as low-cost alternatives to costly current computing systems, which penny-pinching nonprofit boards will not buy. He also has helped adapt 8-bit computers to the special needs of physically challenged persons. The program director of the Santa Barbara PC Users Group, he is not shy about reminding current users of leading-edge personal computer technology of their indebtedness to the early creators of personal computer design. Stephen Stone.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, I'm not sure, as I introduce this topic, why I'm speaking about it. I never really made it to the manufacturing facility for K-Pro Computer down in the San Diego area at Solana Beach. And in case you think that I am a K-Pro aficionado who looked at the company in an uncritical way, let me tell you that I sued K-Pro at one time and lost. And perhaps if we have a little bit of time, I'll offer you an aside on that point. I prepared this presentation asking myself, well, why on earth would people really want to know about K-Pro? It was one of many small computer companies that had success, basically a flash, and then a flame out in a big way, a really big way. K-Pro was not a company that was originally designed or created to build computers. It was based on the work of Andrew Kay, who was an engineer, and Mr. Kay had founded Nonlinear Systems in 1952 to build test equipment, electronic test equipment. In the late 50s, I believe, or maybe the 60s, he invented and proffered the first digital voltmeter, and the company is renowned for that. They really built a lot of sturdy test equipment, and NLS gained a solid reputation as an instrument maker. However, they never really made a lot of money. They spent most of the 50s and 60s selling to aerospace industry and had success and failure with the rise and fall, the cyclical nature of that business. In 1980 or 81, Andrew's son, David Kay, said, "Dad, let's try to build a personal computer. All my research suggests that this is the wave of the future, and we can putter along with the digital test equipment business, but we're never really going to make a lot of money there, and we're always going to be captives to the aerospace industry or whatever industry we're offering our equipment to." Andrew had quite a bit of business experience, and he looked over David's proposition and said, "Yeah, this does look good." They knew people in the industry, the computer industry, who they thought could help them design an excellent model, and they had plenty of experience building field equipment that was hardened for use in the field, really rugged equipment. And so they decided that they could make something that was better than the competition. And Andrew noticed that his son-in-law had been dragging an Apple, probably an Apple II, I'm not sure what model, back and forth in his car from home to work and home to work. And he watched his son-in-law disassemble a disk drive, the monitor, et cetera, and thought, this is terrible. And this is not an easy way to gain portable computing. Why not put it all in one case? And we as digital instrument makers know how to package electronics that way. So we're going to do it. A lot of people thought that the K-Pro was a knockoff of the Osborne. All of my research indicates it was not. It was an original idea occurring simultaneously. Osborne's problems came from the fact that Osborne really hadn't had a lot of experience in designing electronics. And Osborne made some very serious errors in situating the disk drives outboard on either side of the cathode ray tube. So the disk drives were subject to interference from CRT frequencies. K-Pro came up with initially the same design. Disk drives on either side of the CRT. The computer that was built was called the K-Comp. I've never seen one. I think I might have seen a picture of one once, or maybe a early advertising piece that just never made it. They quickly discovered, before they had pumped out any units to speak of, that that wasn't going to work. They built an insulating drive cage and moved both drives over into that cage on the right side of the display. That solved the interference problems. They also decided that they needed to have a readable display and determined that the 9-inch display was the minimum and actually an optimal for visual angle for people to use. So the design was set in many ways by the K's knowledge of electronics in the marketplace, and it proved to be a very successful design. I want to go back and talk a little bit about the K's, because they're unusual people. And Andrew K, some people called him a fanatic, some people said he was a bit of a nut. I've had people offer me personal anecdotes talking about how difficult he was to deal with. But he was someone who had cut his teeth in the electronics industry under the tutelage of a man who had an unusual relationship with his employees in another electronics firm on the East Coast. A firm that offered many incentives to workers, took extra care that their workers were treated in a beneficent fashion. And Andrew had a passion for reading books on management, and he eschewed the current techniques of management of the 50s and the early 60s. He didn't want that kind of an authoritarian relationship with his workers, although he did set guidelines. He was also a friend of the psychologist Abraham Maslow. Some of you may remember Maslow from your Psych 101 courses. Maslow developed the hierarchy of human needs, of higher human needs. He talked about needs that people have beyond mere shelter, clothing, food. He talked about social needs and intellectual needs and emotional needs. And Kay believed that unless those needs were met in the workplace, his workers would feel disrespected and they would not be productive. He proved right in the management style that he affected within NLS and then within the renamed company, which was K-Pro Computer. That name surfaced in 1983 and became the official name of the computer. As a matter of fact, you can tell how old your K-Pro is. The back of the computer will either say NLS for Nonlinear Systems or K-Pro if it's a later version reflecting the renaming of the company. David and Andrew, son and father, created a unique manufacturing facility that reminds me of some of the facilities that I've had described in auto manufacture in the Scandinavian countries. Instead of having a massive automated assembly line, the K's set up an assembly, sort of like a group of work groups. They had teams of workers who were trained by people who were already on the job in an informal fashion, and each work group was responsible for quality control of its product. As a matter of fact, when the K-Pro was originally conceived, they decided that they wouldn't engineer the thing with any pre-existing idea of how it would be assembled. They just knew that there was a certain physical configuration that they wanted, and they handed the parts to the first assembly team and said, here, you figure out how to assemble this. When you put it all together, you're going to have a computer. So instead of management dictating the assembly process, they let the people who are actually going to work on the things figure out how it could best be assembled. And each work group had the opportunity thereafter to devise its own methods of assembly. As long as their quality was up to standards and they were producing a reasonable number of machines, that was okay. And reasonable became defined by independent work groups producing a certain number of machines out of batches of parts that were spread around the campus of assembly. It's really a rather ingenious idea. I haven't seen anything described in management since that bears the description that I've just offered you. It seemed to make for happy workers. Workers were extremely loyal to K-Pro during those early years. And workers were selected by Andrew and David through an unusual method. They talked to the worker for 4 or 5 minutes, and if the person didn't seem hostile, it seemed somewhat eager, and Andrew said if they looked like they had an open face and were open to new ideas, they were hired. They were kept on for 3 days. If they made it, you know, they could integrate into the team. That was great. They were kept in the work group. The preference at K-Pro at the time was to hire people who were friends of or family members of existing workers. They never checked references. If another worker who was good said, I have a family member who needs a job, I think they're a good worker, and they knew that they were going to bear the responsibility for that person coming into their work group, that was okay. They were trusted. K-Pro affected one of the lowest costs of labor per unit and dollar return of any company ever in that time, far better than the artfully managed companies, the big companies, the blue chip companies of the time. And people in schools of management studied K-Pro as a sort of a renegade management example. Many articles were written about it. Maslow actually wrote a book about people coping in the corporation and made K-Pro one of his examples. The idea for the K-Pro, as I said, the machine, was something that originated apparently independently of the Osborne. But when the K's found out about the Osborne, they decided we will meet this challenge. They hadn't seen the machine. They heard the announcement date. And I think wisely, instead of rushing, they chose to take their time and make sure that their first production was a working production run. They also chose to distribute their machines in a different fashion than Osborne. Instead of selling to chains, instead of pushing through the conventional venues of the mass market, they developed a more individual relationship with independent dealers and gave dealers some recognition for their independence. As a matter of fact, the dealer that I bought my second K-Pro from, who's become a good friend since, has told me many anecdotes about his relationship with K-Pro. The relationship that the company had with its dealers was a blessing in two directions. My friend, Byron Eckerson, had a knack for diagnosing things that might not have been finished or working correctly as they came out of QC, quality control, from K-Pro. K-Pro used different components from different manufacturers according to price and availability. The microcomputer climate of 1981, 2, 3, 4 was one where some pretty big companies were competing for the same off-the-shelf components. And if you were a smaller seller or manufacturer, you had to hope that you could obtain product off the shelf. And sometimes the quality, you got the second run of quality. My friend often discovered problems and fixes for the K-Pros that he got at his dealership. And he became so good at diagnosing those that K-Pro would often call him for advice for their final stage of assembly. So the relationship worked both ways. The other thing that the company, let me back up. Osborne chose to work through distributors, having an insulating layer between Osborne and the ultimate seller of the machine. And eventually the distributors and the evolving big box computer stores killed Osborne's profit margin by demanding further and further cuts. They were also hurt by gray marketing, distributors buying quantity and then dumping quantities so they could get a lower price initially and then selling lower. Then when Osborne ran into problems with its design, they had no loyal following. They had no one who was invested in selling Osborne's. It's very difficult for them to get those problems resolved at the field level without having machines returned to the factory, which is very expensive. A very interesting book is Hypergrowth, which Adam Osborne wrote as a postscript to his experience of his company. It's a real page turner. He's a good writer, probably a better writer than a businessman, I'd say. If you haven't read it, check it out. It's fascinating. The K's, of course, I suppose one would say defeated Osborne. Osborne went into Chapter 11, reorganization. The Capro Company continued growing like Topsy, putting severe strains on the small manufacturing campus that they built in Solana Beach. It was difficult for them to obtain materials. They had innovative techniques in marketing, but that kind of growth is going to be extremely stressful for any company. Let me read you what those growth figures were. This is amazing to me today, and maybe some of you may have a sense of what these dollars are worth today, but this article that I'm quoting from was written late 1984, so I imagine it was 3 or 4 months old. And it says that in the year of 1983, growth of the company exploded from $5 million to $75 million. That's growth in any company. And the staff, which had been numbered 100 at the beginning of 1983, numbered 600 by the end of 1983. I can't imagine. In my own businesses, I can't even fathom what it would be like to deal with that kind of growth. By the end of 83 and early 84, Capro was a household word. There was no time to buy additional acreage to and build factories. They had orders that they had to fulfill. Work spilled out of the sort of dormitory-style assembly salons of the Capro campus, and that's how they referred to it, onto lawns. Parts were stored under circus tents. They brought in trailers. For any of you who know the climate of Solana Beach, it can be very sunny and nice. It can also be rather cold and damp. I noticed that some of the Capros I bought at that time had kind of rusty fittings, you know? Corrosive atmosphere, and I'm sure that didn't contribute to their reliability. The other wisdom that Capro affected was in building user loyalty through a company-supported network of user groups. Now, Osborne had pushed a user group, but they didn't support it as directly as Capro. Capro sent representatives out to user groups. They provided a magazine called Profiles, which supported user groups. This magazine, by the way, was in existence from like 1983. A copy was given away with each Capro. It existed till, I think, 1988 or 1989 when it ceased publication. And it actually made it independent of Capro on the newsstands for a while. By 86, 87, 88, the content focused on MS-DOS machines. The articles were so well written in this house journal that it achieved some success on newsstands. But when Capro folded, there was no time to reorganize the magazine's structure, and it went with them. I miss it. I still think it's one of the best computer magazines I've ever seen. Well, what happened to Capro? You know the end of the story. I don't have to offer a long build-up to that. Everyone seems to have theories. I heard one today suggesting that the EPA began to look at manufacturing processes of Capro and didn't like what they were doing at Solana Beach. You can imagine with growth of manufacturing at levels that Capro experienced, just accidents and teams of workers who were green, not knowing how to handle materials, would have caused problems. Other theories are that the K's really needed a quick infusion of capital You know, their accounts receivable weren't catching up with their orders, their shipped orders either. So they were looking for outside venture capital, and they knew that they needed to change from a CPM world to an MS-DOS world, even though they were the champions of the CPM world. So they got advice, I believe, to bring in professional managers from blue chip companies that would give them an air of legitimacy, not just that of a mom and pop store. And I believe that that was a big problem, that at that time, K-Pro's new managers tried to offer a different paradigm than the family styled. We can do it together, not as a team, but as people who help each other in the process of building a product and purveying a product. The two paradigms of professional management and homespun management, radically humanistic management, didn't mesh well. And what occurred thereafter was a series of change of management. Some of the family management got reinstalled in attempts to make things work again. By that time, morale had fallen. Assembly quality wasn't as good as it was. K-Pro spent a lot of money on R&D for MS-DOS computers, and some people say built a really solid computer, MS-DOS computer, but they were also still dependent upon outside suppliers for components, and some of the quality that they got wasn't so good from those second sources. By the time they had good working machines, an attractive suite of bundled software, advertising through established channels, the offshore clone manufacturers had produced a product that was saleable. Not necessarily good, not necessarily compatible, but saleable for hundreds of dollars less than K-Pro. And I think that's what really made it difficult for K-Pro. Their revenues started to fall. The advice they got was bring in more outside managers, we can fix this. Finally, a national periodical reported that they had missing stock, missing inventory, amounting to some millions of dollars. And the SEC came in and said, well, gee, you've misled shareholders in your prospectus and in your quarterly reports. What's going on here? What I've heard from other sources is that inventory wasn't missing. It was there, it was just lost somewhere among circus tents and trailers that were being used for storage. Well, that rumor caused stock to fall and confidence to wane in the company. And you know, they saw the tumble coming very quickly and went into Chapter 11. Successive attempts to reorganize the company didn't produce a management that was any better at taking care of things. By the time the K's started to regain control, things had snowballed and the company was on its way out. K-Pro also had some clashes, I believe, in that time that management was being changed and flip-flopping between the competing paradigms. Dealers sued for, in essence, what they charged was manipulation by K-Pro, trying to support list prices by coercive means. And they never specified that, those means. I'm trying to find the my quotation on that. Well, they settled with the state of California, Department of Consumer Affairs. They settled for $20,000 or something like that. So couldn't have been an awful infraction. But I don't think that the later management knew how to take care of the dealers, the authorized dealers, the independents, who had made K-Pro really what it was. And once the dealers started going sour, a major funnel of goodwill went sour too into the public, the buying public. K-Pro made interesting attempts to offer configurations of CPM computers in 84, 85 that would keep people interested in the operating system and in their configuration of computers. I have a 1985 Robi. The Robi was an interesting departure from the standard CPM machine, which was at that time starting to become a hard drive machine. K-Pro struck a deal with a company called DriveTech, which produced very high density floppy drive machines. These things could be formatted on a K-Pro machine to 2.6 megabytes per floppy. They had a pre-written servo track, factory written, and I acquired a Robi and plugged in the one master disk and found it contained everything that the 10 to 15 disks of software that had come with my other K-Pros, my earlier K-Pros, which had 390K drives. Unfortunately, the early DriveTech drives tended to chew up their disks, so they gained a bad reputation. The company fixed that, but it was too late for that particular design. Still, I think it's a rather brilliant solution. I think it's a brilliant solution to the problems of dealing with hard drive size and unreliability and weight at that time. K-Pro also built interesting menuing systems using their S-Basic language and later made them modifiable by the user. People loved to tinker with K-Pros, even though the machine had no system bus that you could plug more cards into. It wasn't really expandable. Publications like Profiles had article after article on how to modify your K-Pro to make it better. And third parties built all kinds of enhancements for the K-Pro. It was a tinkerer's machine. It was also a writer's machine. Most of the people I knew in Santa Barbara at the time who bought K-Pros in the 83, 84 era were writers. And I helped some of them deal with their problems. And my name is mentioned in more than a few prefaces to books, both cursing me and thanking me for introducing people to the machine. I understand I wasn't working in the computer industry at the time. I was a psychotherapist and social worker who had simply adopted computers. K-Pro was also the first company to have brought out a CPM machine that came with a bundled suite of usable software, the the K-Pro 1083. My memory serves to recall that in 1982, a 5 megabyte hard drive was still over $2,000. In 1983, K-Pro was offering their second machine, or third machine, the K-Pro 1083, with a 10 megabyte hard drive, full suite of software, close to 400K floppy drive for $2,795. People found that was a real bargain. Now, I was in much better shape when I was carrying around my K-Pro 10 Luckable. It was a heavy but serviceable machine, and you could put it on an airplane and knock it around, and it would work well. Speaking of the ruggedness of the K-Pro, I have a friend who's a contractor at that time who used to take his K-Pro on the back of his pickup truck. And he'd hook it up to a power supply he could run off his truck battery. What do you call it? An inverter. And one day, he was exhausted at the end of a job in the field and forgot that he'd left the K-Pro perched on the tailgate of his truck. Took off down a side road, hit something like 35 or 45 miles per hour and heard a ka-chunk, looked in the rearview mirror and saw his K-Pro doing loop-de-loops on the pavement in back of him. Well, the case was badly scratched and the corners were a bit dented. The keyboard didn't become detached. The CRT didn't break. He took it home, plugged it in, and it ran. And he continued using it on his truck. Again, these guys built field test equipment. They knew how to build a ruggedized chassis that would protect electronic components. The CUGs continued, the K-Pro user groups continued as an important vehicle of disseminating information about K-Pros. Most of the CUG members were pretty much dyed-in-the-wool CPM folks, and they didn't take kindly to the introduction of MS-DOS machines. So K-Pro didn't have that source of word-of-mouth advertising. K-Pro actually didn't have a very good system of advertising anyway. On the web, I found things that jogged my memory about some of the ads that K-Pro attempted. One was a ad which ran on television, and they could only afford to run this ad a few times in six major US cities. It shows a customer going into a computer shop in somewhere around 1984, and the customer says to the salesperson, "Customer, yes, I'd like to buy this $1,200 computer you have in your ad." And the salesman says, "That will be $5,300 complete. You need to add a monitor, software, this, that, etc." And the customer looks like he's going to faint dead away. And then the announcer cuts in and says, "Why don't you buy the computer that you can get for the price it's advertised for?" And the screen shows the K-Pro, all the software and manuals sped around it. And the customer's response is, "Wow." The ad man who wrote this ad said that after it ran, sales actually declined in those cities because people became aware of the brand name computers that were featured in the ad. And I guess they went out and bought those brand name computers even though they cost two or three times as much as the K-Pro. So that was advertising that worked against K-Pro. The same ad man who didn't really understand much about the K-Pro, I must say, but apparently listened when he got some guidance, wrote ads for education and business that were rather neat, and I wish I had these today. I can't read them to you, because all I have is a little graphic from the internet. But I remember these as spreads in the LA Times and the New York Times, and one ad that ran for a little while in 83 or 84 said 10 questions to ask before you buy your business computer. And they were good questions at the time. And of course, the answer to every question, or the amalgam of questions that the K-Pro hoped the user would come up with, was it doesn't make any sense to buy the big guy's computer. Buy a K-Pro. That ad worked. That ad worked. It really built revenue for K-Pro. A second ad was aimed at education, hoping to get the market away from Apple to some degree. That ad had a banner that read, "It won't destroy planets," obviously referring to the tendency of computer manufacturers applying to the education market to make educational software that would blast them and blow them up. Whatever, you know, read by destroying worlds. Learn to read, learn to spell by destroying planets. And that worked well. K-Pro actually gained a little bit of a foothold in schools. And the K-Pro education software at the time was really pretty good. It was very good quality. Other attempts to advertise K-Pro included promotions to the user groups, large ads in this organ, the profiles that were already working, and ads within what was called the CUGRAM, which was an a production of a private group of user groups that came out of New York. I don't know much about that organization, although I joined in its late years. K-Pro had done a pretty good job of deciding immediately that a suite of software that was complete was important to people who really didn't know what they wanted in a microcomputer but didn't want to plunk down a lot more money after their initial outlay. K-Pro used the Perfect Suite, written by Perfect Software in Berkeley, California. The feature piece of that software suite was Perfect Writer. How many of you used Perfect Writer? Know what it was? Now, Perfect Writer was an Emacs editor with a formatter and a printer module, and they were all tied together by a menu. Users who had any experience with a system learned very quickly that they didn't need the menu to tie the components of this Emacs editor, formatter, and printer together. They could use each module as they wanted to. People used other formatters, they used other print drivers. One company, PluPerfect Systems, in 84, rebuilt PluPerfect Writer into what they termed PluPerfect Writer by sending out an automated patch for PluPerfect, for Perfect Writer, that fixed a lot of its bugs and really made it a very nice Emacs editor. People who, of course, who grew up, cut their teeth on the Emacs editor, Perfect Writer, got into internet HTML tags and understood what was there. But people who had never seen formatting tags in a document hated Perfect Writer because it didn't give them the ultimate view of what would occur for them when they printed the document. They didn't like having to reformat if there are errors. And so K-Pro, at the beginning of 84, started to offer the Perfect Suite and the popular WordStar Suite, where people could get WYSIWYG, what you see is what you get, on your word processor. It didn't take long for the user community to figure out that Perfect Writer was a pretty good editor, and WordStar was a pretty good formatter and printer, and a lot of people used both together. I did that too and found it wasn't all that difficult. But then I'm a psychotherapist and I'm used to dealing with complex relationships. Eventually, K-Pro gave up on the Perfect series. And just offered the WordStar suite to compete with Osborne, to get a leg up on Osborne. They offered DBase 2 as part of their package. They offered menuing systems, communications packages like Mite as part of the software suite. Anything to get a leg up on the competition that didn't cost them too much as they bundled the software with their computer. Eventually, in the waning time of CPM, whenever that was, K-Pro realized that many people would still like to have a simple machine, and K-Pro began to offer their newer CPM computer in different hardware configurations. They offered a one-drive machine, which they called the New 2. A customer could get a second floppy drive for $495, that's $495 as an upgrade, along with some extra software. They added fans, removed fans. In the end, I think the last CPM machine was called the K-Pro 1. Remember, we started out with a K-Pro K-Comp computer, that was the original prototype. Then we went to the Roman numeral 2 K-Pro, that had single-sided drives. Don't trip me up here. Then we went to the K-Pro 4, Roman numeral K-Pro 4, 2 megahertz processor, same as the K-Pro 2, double-sided drives. Then we went to the 484, which had double-sided drives, a 4 megahertz processor, a built-in modem, a built-in real-time clock, an extra port, light pen port, the 10 configuration. Things got really confusing. Finally, K-Pro came out with something called a universal ROM that worked in their hard drive machines, their floppy drive machines of any configuration, the Robi, and it seems to be one other machine. And that actually had some interesting programming features. Different versions of CPM were released too, and that confused people all the more. I tinkered with all the stuff and worked on other people's machines. I have to call around to other people who I consider authorities to set me out straight on which version to use with what ROM. Got very confusing. I actually bought a Turbo ROM from the guys who did PluPerfect Systems, and that provided me with some universal access to software. I just take the ROM out, plug it into a different machine, and I knew that my software would run on that machine. Kind of difficult thing to do. Bridger Mitchell and Derek Mackay also created software for the K-Pro, which would allow the reading and writing to of MS-DOS 360K diskettes, which meant that you could edit a WordStar document on your K-Pro on a 360 diskette, or translate it from the hard drive, copy it from your hard drive to a 360K diskette, transparently plug it into an IBM compatible, run the IBM version, the MS-DOS version of WordStar, and not have to bother with any kind of format translation. It was a good solution for people who might have used a K-Pro at home and an IBM, a True Blue at work. Did I mention about, talk much about the Robi? I want to get back to that machine because it's a neat machine. It's a cube. Some of you may have noticed the K-Pro Robi in old version, old Star Trek episodes. It was such an interesting looking machine. It was a cube, 9-inch monitor. The drive sat in a blister on the top of the cube, and it looked very futuristic. It had, you know, neat lights running, and the Star Trek producers thought it looked neat enough to make it a prop in several of the Star Trek episodes. 1985 went on, and K-Pro introduced the machine that some of you saw at my desk, the K-Pro 2000, a 16-pound laptop. I still have bruises from trying to write on that one. They introduced the K-Pro 16, their first attempt at a computer in the configuration that looked more like their CPM machines, their luggable machines. Same heavy-duty, bulletproof case, MS-DOS computer with an unusual configuration. I can't describe it to you. You recognize it as a different computer when you see it. They went into the production of 286 machines and took original approaches in those designs, too, that aren't apparent to the eye immediately. They insisted on using upper memory, a portion of upper memory, for RAM drive. The company actually built three 86 machines as well and advertised them as being made in America, really good quality machines. And I know people who are still using those machines. They lasted till today. They must have had some quality. The decline of K-Pro occurred, as I suggested, as a result of several factors. And I always wondered what happened to the Ks. I asked my friend, the dealer, Byron Eckerson, what he knew of the decline of K-Pro, and he said, well, they kept a sort of a token force in Solana Beach and attempted to resurrect the company whenever they could. At one point, they were forbidden during the reorganization from manufacturing until the reorganization had been completed. And as late as 27 June 1990, this is from the San Diego Union Tribune, K-Pro said yesterday it had resumed production to fill a backlog of over $500,000 in orders, as well as new orders valued at over $1 million received since last Wednesday. The company president, or the company chief executive officer, who was an associate of Andrew Kay, said K-Pro will make substantial progress in the next month. I don't think they really emerged from that reorganization. They had outside managers by that point who were looking over the inside manager's shoulders, and the magic was no longer there. David Kay and Andrew Kay had built a machine called the Computer Tutor back in 1980 as they were looking for things other than digital test equipment to build. They had conceived of a computer-aided system for helping school children and others learn more powerful vocabulary. The 1980 prototype didn't work very well, required a lot of maintenance. After K-Pro finally closed its doors, Andrew Kay went to work for another member of the family who was also in the high-tech industry in Kay Computing, or Kay Computers, and I don't know what that company manufactures. It still exists today. Andrew Kay is still alive, still taking part in San Diego's